Hi, Abel.
Hey Bob, how are you?
Good, how are you doing?
Good, thanks.
Okay, well, I should tell people that I'm Bob Wright of Blogging Heads TV, and you are Adel Iskander. Did I pronounce that right?
Absolutely, perfectly.
Okay, and you teach at Georgetown University at the Center for Contemporary Arab Studies.
That's correct, yes.
And you are a columnist for the English website of an Egyptian newspaper whose name I'm not going to try to pronounce. You can
Yes,
if you
it's
want.
Al-Masri Al-Yom.
Exactly. That's
Yes.
exactly what I would have said. But most important, you're the author of a book, Al Jazeera, The Story of the Network That Is Rattling Governments and Redefining Modern Journalism. And of course, Al Jazeera has been very much in the news. I mean, it has been the news lately. It's been covering, and I think doing a better job probably than any other broadcaster of covering all the news from the Arab world lately. But I think more than people may realize, it has influenced events in the Arab world. I know that you think that it helped pave the way for the Egyptian revolution in ways that are more subtle than people might understand. And I know you also think that it covers different countries differently. So, for example, it did not provide the same kind of unblinking, intense coverage of Bahrain as it did Egypt, maybe, and I think you have some ideas about why that is. So I want to get into all that and the subtleties of Al Jazeera and the way, it really has changed the world in ways that are just now becoming apparent. But I wonder if you could start off at the beginning, because I think that some of the things people don't understand about Al Jazeera, some of the politics surrounding Al Jazeera, have to do with how it started, where it started, and its relationship to the government in the place where it started, which is Qatar, right?
Yes, absolutely. And I think it is a fairly good way to start a conversation about Al Jazeera. The station came into being in 1996 and very much grew out of a failed experiment, a defunct experiment in 24-hour all-news Arabic broadcasting. It was shortly after the first Gulf War in 1991, and Arab audiences were basically yearning for something that was akin to CNN, that they wanted news coverage of that kind that gave them sort of unfettered access to what was happening in the streets, what was happening in these war zones, essentially, but it was accessible in the Arabic language. So there was a joint venture between a Saudi company very close to the royal family and BBC, at the time the most credible news organization in the Arab world, or perceived as the most credible news organization. The venture was based out of London. It was called BBC Arabic Television. It was supposed to be editorially independent from any government in the region, but they came across some major problems at the very outset. They wanted to air a program on Saudi executions, Saudi public executions, which the Saudi funders felt was incredibly problematic, and they essentially threatened the editors and the producers and the executives in the company, that if they were to go to air, that they would retract funding. And in an attempt to be editorially independent, they decided to go ahead and air the show. And that was essentially the last of the BBC World Service Arabic TV station. So once it fell apart, the Emir of Qatar, a newly crowned Emir, Sheikh Hamad bin Khalifa Al Thani, recognized that as an opportunity to essentially start a news organization that had the same motto, the same approach, same sort of level of professionalism as the BBC, but was based in the Arab world. At the time, Qatar was unknown to the majority of people, both in the region and beyond. It's very difficult to find on a map, let alone know anything about the inhabitants and the policies of the government of Qatar. So he literally relocated a small group of these producers that became the nucleus of Al Jazeera. And the rest is history, essentially. I mean, so they had to cast themselves in contrast to all the other national broadcasters. Again, you have to remember, traditionally, government broadcasters in the region are run by ministries of information. They're very rigid, they're very directive, they're very bland. The top story is almost always these sort of ceremonial meetings that the head of state is having, and it's all incredibly positive. Everything has a positive twist. So it didn't really resonate with the public. So Al Jazeera had to create an early splash to be able to stand out in this very, very dull media environment. And that's exactly what they did from the outset. They started criticizing local governments, regional governments, and inviting dissidents and people who had, you know, varying political perspectives to the ruling regimes. And we see that, you know, starting in 1996 all the way to today in 2011, you still see that Al Jazeera makes its bread and butter from allowing, you know, political dissidents to go on air and criticize their governments, whether those governments happen to be regional or global. The United States has been on the receiving end of much of that criticism as well. So it's an incredibly interesting experiment in broadcasting that emerged from an area of the world where, you know, openness and political openness and political expression and freewheeling media have never been traditional.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, one thing I'm curious about is why did all these governments let Al Jazeera continued to broadcast? Probably very few of them were enthusiastic about it, right? And in principle, I mean, it is satellite TV, which is easier in principle to control than some other new media, right?
Well, actually, it's a little bit more complicated than that. I mean, first of all, why it is that the governments in the region couldn't contain the network? I mean, they've tried. There've been a lot of very serious attempts to contain the network. We're talking about governments that have either retracted diplomatic relations with Qatar for sponsoring Al Jazeera. Some of them have, many instances, detained journalists, beat up journalists, shut down their bureaus, confiscate their equipment, as in the case of Egypt, the Egyptian revolution recently. So the network is no stranger to these policies that try to silence it. But in almost every circumstance, these efforts have actually backfired. Mm-hmm. The network does not shy away from describing the difficult climate in which they have to operate. So when journalists and the Al Jazeera reporters in Egypt were subjected to very heavy censorship and confiscation of their equipments and their brief detention, all of that was broadcast on air immediately. Mm-hmm. And they've used that to discredit the legitimacy of these governments, to show that they have something to hide. Early in the first few years of Al Jazeera's broadcasting, they received somewhere in the range of 400 official complaints from Arab governments, and there are only 22 Arab governments, so you can mm-hmm. tell how incredibly problematic their coverage was. Mm-hmm. So I think the general consensus right now is that it's very, very difficult to silence satellite networks.
So you would have to ban satellite dishes, which, you know, they're kind of conspicuous. I guess you could try that, but aside
which
from
has
that,
been attempted. It's been attempted, Bob. I mean, the Saudis have tried to ban satellite dishes. There's still a law in the books that prohibits owning and possessing and selling and installing satellite dishes. The Iraqis have attempted that.
Why does it fail? Just because you need too many police, or what?
You need so many police, and also the demand is unbelievable. I mean, the majority of Arab publics want these satellite dishes, not necessarily for news, but for basic entertainment. Mm-hmm. They want their MTVs, they want their reality television shows, they want their music networks, they want theatrical performances. All of this stuff is very intriguing. I mean, you can't take away all of this. And national broadcasting is so bland and so unimaginative that the quality programs went out.
So it's mainly for actually the non-news content that most Arabs demand Al Jazeera.
If you look at the viewing patterns, I mean, most of the viewership is actually not news. Of course, in moments of political turmoil, such as the last couple of months in the Arab world, you see a huge spike mm-hmm. in news viewership. But in general, on ordinary days, I mean, if you were an Egyptian for the last 30 years, news wasn't the big deal. So people watched a lot of entertainment programming both from regional broadcasters as well as international. People watch the Western stations as well, the American sort of movie channels and things of the sort. So They're just like us, you know. Arabs are just like us. They're the same kinds of audiences. They'll watch the reality television shows, their cooking shows, the religious programming, and then from time to time, when it's necessary, news steals.
And why does the government of Qatar want to do something that annoys virtually all of its neighbors?
That's a very good question. I think to a great extent, it's a fairly clever approach, largely because they understand that Arab audiences and Arab publics in general are very disenchanted with their regimes. You know, you're talking about an area that has had political stagnation for decades, economic disparities in some areas, and the aspirations of the public are so immense that if you were to challenge these regimes, you will win the hearts and minds of these publics. It's a fairly simple formulaic approach, but it's worked in their favor. And that's part of the reason why, in many instances, Al Jazeera has some of the highest ratings of viewership across the Arab world, because they are prepared to place themselves on the other side of power, on the other side of these regimes. And the more critical they are of the different centers of power, the more they resonate with these publics. That's not to say that everybody loves Al Jazeera. Of course, there are people who abhor and think it's a despicable, you know, station. So there's a tremendous amount of criticism, largely because the station has become almost a monopoly on news. I mean, it's the go-to source of information for many people in the Arab world, and their coverage, you know, may or may not please everyone. But at the end of the day, they've made their name out of critical coverage in relation to these Arab governments. So they're actually more popular. I mean, if you would think about it, their version of the truth, Al Jazeera's version of the truth, as biased as it may be in some instances, is more appealing to audiences in the Arab world than their own governments.
Okay, well, let's talk about bias. First of all, would you say that in general its stance toward Arab governments is much like the stance of American journalism toward the American government? In other words, skeptical, critical, intent on revealing wrongdoing, corruption, and so on? Are those, broadly speaking, the values that infuse Al Jazeera?
To a large extent, yes. I think that their journalistic integrity comes from the same position of wanting to be professional and keeping the public interest in mind, that public interest is the prime priority that needs to be addressed by any network that wants to espouse, a good journalistic sort of value. So I think they do serve as a watchdog, essentially, for all of the regional governments, especially in the circumstance where national broadcasters do not do that. I mean, Libyan television does not criticize the Libyan government. Neither does the Egyptian television or the Saudi or anyone else.
What about criticism of the Qatari government?
That's, I think, one of the points of contention that that Al Jazeera has not been able to address so much. I mean, yes, they've had one or two shows where they discuss, parliamentary problems and electoral problems in Qatar, and the fact that there's no political, you know, representation in the country. They've also had a few shows about the complicated relationship between the Qatari government and the United States and Israel and other Arab countries, as well as Iran and Hezbollah and Hamas. But still, it's definitely disproportionate. I mean, their concentration is on other Arab regimes. So they're constantly looking out, and they usually justify it by saying there's nothing particularly interesting going on in Qatar. Qatar is a small peninsular state in the Gulf that, you know, it's a negligible place. But, of course, that is...
I've been there, and I'm telling you, not much was happening, so far as I could tell, except for the construction of an incredible number of skyscrapers.
Yes, which means that there's a lot of money being funneled through Qatar. So, a lot of it is happening without any scrutiny. So, for most Arab governments and Arab publics, they also want to know what's going on in Qatar. I mean, it's one of the fastest-growing economies in the region. It's becoming a major player. they're going to be hosting the Soccer World Cup in 2022. They have the Doha debates. You've had the Doha Forum. I mean, there's a lot going on, a lot more going on in Doha, you know.
It's also becoming kind of reconciliation central. I mean, they like to convene, leaders of countries and stuff and help them talk things out and stuff. You know, it's becoming a very significant place. Talk a little about how Al Jazeera's relationship to the government of Qatar may have influenced its coverage of recent events. In particular, I'm thinking of Bahrain. A lot of people noted that Al Jazeera didn't seem quite as intent on covering the unrest in Bahrain as it had in Egypt. And what's your theory on this?
Well, I think that's a fairly good assessment of the contrast between coverage of, let's say, Egypt and Tunisia and Libya and Bahrain. Bahrain, of course, is kilometers away. It's an island off the coast of Saudi Arabia and very close to Qatar. And so whatever happens in Bahrain will almost certainly splash on Qatar. And we're talking about regional politics that are far more complicated than a tiny island. So we're talking about Iranian-Saudi relations and control in the region. Of course, all manifesting in a Shia-Sunnah divide within the country. again, very parallel to that of Qatar. Qatar has a very similar sort of economic and political structure to that of Bahrain. Right. So it was definitely not in the interest of Al Jazeera to focus too much on the Bahraini circumstance.
So in other words, with Bahrain, the unrest was starting to get a little too close to home for Qatar's purposes.
Absolutely.
And you think Al Jazeera's coverage reflected that?
I mean, there were some instances where the coverage improved and other instances it deteriorated. So there were fluctuations.
Yeah.
But in general, the observers of the previous two revolutions in Tunisia and Egypt would tell you that, Al Jazeera was very much either advocating for or coming out in favor of representing the voices of the dissidents.
Mm-hmm.
And in the case of Bahrain, they were walking a very tight rope. They were basically sitting on the fence, that they were mm-hmm. very, very cautious who they put on air and to say what.
Mm-hmm.
So that may be a good area of criticism for Al Jazeera, something that they will have to address in the future, because Bahrain is not going away. Come back to haunt them.
In
later.
Egypt, on the other hand, it had been said that Al Jazeera had, I don't know, might not say a vendetta against Mubarak, but there was kind of a sense of antagonism between Al Jazeera and the Egyptian regime for some time before the revolution, right?
Yeah, to a large extent, yes. I think, Mubarak became a very, very easy target, largely because, the country was sort of liberalizing in some sort of quarters, because you had a growing independent press, you had private Egyptian satellite stations. So it became very fashionable to criticize the Egyptian government. But Al Jazeera took it up, at least a few notches over most of the other networks, and I think that rubbed the Egyptian regime in a way that they didn't like, and especially when it comes to regional politics that the Egyptian government was not prepared to address. So, for instance, the war, Israeli war on Gaza, and the Israeli war on Lebanon, and Egypt's sort of perceived complicity in blockading Gaza. Those were very, very touchy subjects for the Mubarak regime, and they didn't want to venture into that. And Al Jazeera basically pounded them day in, day out.
Did it pound them because it has an ideology with respect to Israel, or was it more an attempt to cater to the demands of the Arab public, which has an ideology with respect to Israel?
I mean, the real question is, can you really tear those apart? If Al Jazeera is a voice for the Arab public, or is at least responsive to the Arab street sentiments, the two sort of fall in line. I mean, we understand that Israeli policies are not particularly popular in the Arab world, so Al Jazeera may be catering to that, but also responding to what they believed were genuine concerns. So they obviously used evidence from international human rights organizations to support their position that Israel was committing crimes against humanity or war crimes or something along those lines, and holding the Egyptian government partially responsible.
Mm-hmm.
And of course that resonated very well with the Arab publics as a whole. Again, they know who their audience is. They've been working with this audience since 1996, so they understand public opinion indicators far better than their competition. And in some instances, they sway in favor of one versus another. But at the end of the day, I don't think they've essentially sacrificed their integrity as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I've argued that there's a way to present information that is both factually correct and at the same time nuanced enough that it fits into the context of what audiences expect. I mean, you watch American television, and it's distinctly American. Sometimes it's difficult to figure out what makes American news American, but for foreigners, for non-Americans to watch it, there is that sort of subtlety, the sensibilities, the arguments that makes it distinctly American. And that's essentially what Al Jazeera has perfected. They perfected the art of presenting news in a manner that appeals to Arab audiences, because they know the priorities that that Arabs have in relation to politics and history and okay. identity and things of that sort.
So to a large extent, I mean, if we set aside those issues that have to do with Al Jazeera being in Qatar and symbiotic with the Qatar government, if we set those aside, you would say that the drift of its coverage has less to do with some sort of well-articulated ideology that it's trying to push, and more to do with it wanting to do things that resonate with the Arab public. So it winds up reflecting the ideology of Arabs.
Yes, to an extent. Although I would argue, I would take this even farther and sort of connect it with the previous point, which is to say that contemporary Arab identity probably has a lot to do with dissidents right now. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're watching these revolutions unfold from one country to the next, largely because the contemporary identity of Arabs has been formulated by a combination of you know, confronting colonialism up until the mid-1950s, and then confronting post-colonial dictatorships from the 1950s onwards. Mm-hmm. So you have publics that need to confront these structures of control. And Al Jazeera recognizes this and really taps into it. So in some ways, it's a symbiotic relationship between being responsive to the public's needs and at the same time helping sort of instill the desire for freedom. And it starts with freedom of information. I mean, again, mm-hmm. before the arrival of satellite television in the Arab world, there was no contestation of messages. The messages were all incredibly government-oriented, straight mm-hmm. propaganda. And so Al Jazeera basically stirred the pot in such a way that allowed people to express themselves. Right. And that expression may have snowballed to turn into massive dissident movements.
Yeah, so you think it really had a big effect on what we're seeing now? I mean, what we've heard more about is the role of Facebook and Twitter and so on, but how would you compare the role of Al Jazeera relative to those to the social media and the internet?
Well, I'd hate to cast it as a competition between satellite TV and new media, but the point that you're making is well taken, because I think it's more so a marriage between those different technologies, that it's a convergence of the technology and the styles and approaches. You take Libya, for instance. I mean, you've got very limited internet penetration, probably no more than less than a quarter of the population has access to the internet, mm-hmm. and very few of them use Facebook or Twitter. But the learning curve has been exceptionally high after the recent circumstance, because they need to get the information out as fast as possible, especially to their diaspora community. But Al Jazeera, on the other hand, or the satellite networks, are accessible to every home in Libya. So they can propagate these messages far, far more efficiently mm-hmm. than the internet. But the two are basically coming together and amplifying, amplifying mm-hmm. and expediting these mm-hmm. messages. So I would argue that the revolutions with satellite TV and new media are basically revolutions on steroids.
Right.
They're much faster and much more efficient, they can unfold in literally a matter of days rather than months and years. Mm-hmm. So it is a combination of the two. It's sort of like a 1-2 punch.
Yeah.
Between both satellite TV and new media, without one of them taking full credit, there's definitely no causal relationship. There's no cause and effect relationship between one of those technologies and the revolutions. And again, one has to remember that there's a tremendous amount of unpredictability in these revolutions.
Right.
I mean, if you were to ask the average Egyptian, even those who were demonstrating in Tahrir Square a month ago, that whether or not they expected for there to be a revolution or whether they would participate in a revolution, many of them wouldn't have answered affirmatively.
Mm-hmm.
So these things revolutions have a way of taking people by surprise. And once a revolution is in order, once it's rolling, all the tools at people's disposal are utilized to make it happen, to make it resonate.
Yeah, but don't you think that this technological environment, I mean, obviously revolutions, in order to happen, have to have, you know, there are certain prerequisites,
yes,
like discontent, you know,
yes,
determination on the part of the people and so on. Mm-hmm. But sometimes revolutions fail. And don't you think the new technologies compared to the information technologies in place 30, 40 years ago do facilitate revolution, do make it more likely that that kind of fierce discontent will wind up succeeding in its political goals?
I mean, we've seen internet revolutions not, you know, come to fruition, as in the case of Iran and elsewhere. But nevertheless, I think you're partially correct. But again, it is sort of a marriage of the technologies. I mean, if it wasn't for the fact that you had satellite television broadcasting information that was being relayed by the social networking sites to, 300 million homes, you wouldn't have that sort of exponential growth in number of protesters.
Right.
So it's a combination of the two. I mean, when you're talking about Egypt, for instance, the majority of people who are protesting in the streets had actually never touched a keyboard before in their lives. And not to mention the fact that most people had never even heard of Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
There were people asking each other in the square, what is this Facebook revolution?
Right.
Why is this revolution called the Facebook revolution? Because they'd essentially never heard of it. But of course, the revolution was called online. It was initiated online by groups that do have technological savviness. So I think it's a combination of the two. Even some of the protesters who came out initially, who had been behind this internet campaign, when they went out into the streets and marched through the busiest roads, they walked around and clapped and said, "Inzil, Inzil," which means come down to the street, calling on the people who are in their sort of daily slumber in their homes, who knew nothing about the revolution, to come down,
mm-hmm,
and express their dissent. And so it was a snowball effect, and the snowball may have started at the top of the mountain, and the top of the mountain may be on these Facebook pages, but once it was at the bottom of the mountain,
yeah,
it had grown so much, so exponentially, that it included so many different segments of the population,
right,
many of whom had never been online in their lives.
Yeah, well, it sounds like Facebook and Twitter were more like organizing technologies used,
yes,
by the leaders, and Al Jazeera had prepared the ground for a mass following for those,
yes,
leaders.
Absolutely. I mean, you needed to have a prism and a lens on what was going on the ground, and in many instances, satellite television did that very adeptly. But you also wanted the power of social networking sites to distribute information between one another.
Mm-hmm.
The real power of social networking and social media has actually been in creating spaces where people negotiated the revolution, where they talked,
mm-hmm,
about what the next steps should be, what they should do after getting a million people on the streets,
right,
whether they should head to the presidential palace. A lot of this was happening online, and I don't think the staged process, the serial nature, the sequence of the revolution is really credited,
right,
to social media. But I think that is the core, because every revolution isn't just a starting point and an end point. But
yeah,
it's very much a battle for will and a battle for the human imagination and for the essence of dissent. And a lot of that happened online. Now, the cyber battles and the cyber discussions and debates that were going on online were absolutely captivating in the 18-day period,
mm-hmm,
that led up to the resignation,
right,
from Mubarak.
I saw a very smart analysis arguing that Facebook had helped the revolutionaries, the dissidents, solve the collective action problem. In other words, a collective action problem is when, yes, there are a bunch of people who together want to accomplish some goal, but it's not in the interest of any one of them to step out and bear the burden alone. And you want to know before you step out front that you've got a lot of other people who are going to do their share. And in authoritarian states, that's a kind of forbidding prospect. You don't want to be the first one to go out on the street and start,
yeah,
yelling things about the government, right? And what this analysis argued was that Facebook put enough of these people, mainly kind of elite people, well-educated leaders, together to give them all a sense that they were not alone, that But yeah, when they went out on the street, there would be other people. And then, of course, once there was that initial crowd visible to all the people who weren't so hooked up to the internet but watched Al Jazeera, then they saw that they would not be alone, and it was easier to join. And I think, you know, I never thought of it that way, but it makes sense to me, I guess.
I think that's a very accurate assessment. You know, if you were to look at how, you know, some of these groups organized, I mean, what they did was they started these pages online and tried to draw people in, and there was a tremendous amount of reluctance initially. I mean, I know people who wanted to, for instance, support Mohammed al-Baradei, the former IAEA head who became sort of a major player in the revolution. Some of them wanted to add themselves to his Facebook page, but were incredibly reluctant to do so for fear that it might have repercussions on them and their families, that somehow the Egyptian authorities would be able to trace them and find them, arrest them, prevent them from entering or leaving the country, things of that sort. And so that fear barrier was very difficult to break initially. But once it appeared as though there was a huge groundswell, at least online, in support of these campaigns, then it seemed, you know, it seemed real. It seemed like it could materialize. And one might argue that these Facebook groups that started the revolution or called for the revolution actually had a few test runs initially. They had a lot of, they would call for several silent protests where there wasn't direct confrontation anyway with the police force from June 10th all the way through until early January. And those were attempts to bring people out in the streets. They never had the momentum to really be called revolutions, and they never called for the fall of the regime. But at least they had learned a few lessons along the way, how to gather people, how to bring them out, and again, overcoming the fear barrier so that people walked out expecting others to be there. But even the most optimistic of organizers, like the April 6th movement, the youth movement that started, one of the youth movements that started the campaign, they did not anticipate the tens of thousands of people on the first day. And to the extent that the following day, they had to sort of go back to their drawing boards and wonder, you know, what next? I mean, are we going to ask for a regime change? Or how far do we take this? This is phenomenal. Yeah. And even though their initial plan was to call for another day of protest, a day of rage on Friday, they were surprised to see people automatically and without instigation coming out into the streets on Wednesday and Thursday before the day of rage. So obviously by that point, the cat was out of the box. I mean, it was done. It was a lost cause, and whatever it is that they instigated had taken on a life of its own.
Can you talk a little about how in the years prior to all this, Al Jazeera had been, in any sense, paving the way for this?
Yeah, I think it's important to note that, you know, for a long time, the Arab world had not been known to be a sort of a bastion for freedom of expression or freedom of opinion or freedom of the press. And there are a lot of examples of how that is the case. But, you know, the emergence of Al Jazeera was sort of a slow chipping away on these incredibly rigid institutions.
Were there specific Egyptian cases, things that Al Jazeera focused on in Egypt
They covered everything. They covered everything from the government's crackdown on the Muslim Brotherhood over the span of 10 years, from arrested detentions to torture. Also, the shutting down of most political opposition, even those liberal institutions like Al Ghad Party, a prominent party that fielded a candidate that ran against Mubarak in the only contested election in 2005. They covered that in vivid detail. They've covered police brutality against protesters. They've covered the economic sort of disparities and the divide between rich and poor. I mean, so basically Al Jazeera left no stone unturned when it comes to the Egyptian government. So they've angered them in more ways than one, and the Egyptian regime simply didn't know what to do with them. The number of shows dedicated to Egypt over the last 7 or 8 years has been astronomic. I mean, we're talking about at least 20% of all talk shows and talk and debate shows on Al Jazeera had something to do with Egypt. So Egypt was essentially a work in progress for Al Jazeera, and may have been an experiment in their influence. But at the same time, it's important not to overestimate the power of Al Jazeera. Many Egyptians actually took this criticism to heart and felt as though, you know, as if Qatar had nothing to really complain about. I mean, what's Qatar? Qatar is a small, negligible country in the region that doesn't really have a viable democracy. Who are they to come and tell us how to run our own country? So there's a little bit of nationalist defensiveness against Al Jazeera. But at the end of the day, I think it was sort of an incremental process, sort of one step at a time leading up to, you know, enough dissent and enough dissidence and enough comfort for people to express themselves that eventually it opened up. And at the same time, I think it's important to note that whatever worked in Al Jazeera's criticism was actually emulated by some Egyptian satellite stations. So now there's maybe five or six different satellite stations in Egypt that reproduce the political debate shows, these discussion shows, very much like, you know, the former program, what is it, CNN's Crossfire. So these debate shows are incredibly common, as well as talk shows, Egyptian talk shows, where they delve into really critical stuff, really critical information. You know, so I think Al Jazeera's impact is more so emulation than it is.
So it goes beyond what's on Al Jazeera itself. It by breaking the mold and becoming a much more authentic source of information, it inspired competitors.
Absolutely, absolutely, unquestionably. And I think it's happening, you know, not just in Egypt, but beyond. Every Arab country now is either, you know, either has a private satellite station that will delve into regional and domestic politics far more than the state broadcaster, or they will probably have one in the next few years, given the speed at which all of these things happening in the region. So so Al Jazeera is, you know, is an interesting experiment. But again, it's very much steeped in Western journalistic principles. It's no different from, you know, the institutions that we believe produce good journalism. And that's essentially what the Arab world had been yearning for many, many years. And now that these principles are becoming more and more ingrained within the journalistic sort of establishment in the Arab world, it's a lost cause for many of these state broadcasters. They look like dinosaurs now in comparison. I mean, you watch Libyan television and Bahraini television and Egyptian television over the last few months, and it's just archaic stuff.
Yeah, these governments, I mean, in a way, technology has hit them from two different sides. On the one hand, you know, the internet and so on has made it harder for them to control, you know, locally produced and consumed information, right? I mean, the information can bubble up from the grassroots and spread in ways that are harder to control. But with satellite TV, it's made it harder for them to seal their borders, so to speak, against information coming from the outside. I mean, 30-40 years ago, neither of these things were big problems. If you look at the height of, say, the Soviet Union's totalitarian control, you know, the technology made it very easy to be the sole source of television in the country and for the government to be, and to more or less control the printing presses, because, you know, people didn't have computers, desktop computers and printers. Xerox machines were just starting to show up. And if you compare that to the situation a government faces now, you know, it just does not look good for authoritarian governments, it seems to me.
No, you're absolutely right. And while, you know, challenging the sort of the Soviet media machinery was primarily, you know, other foreign government broadcasters like Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, or even, you know, the some very, very small independent press in the Soviet Union. Now we're talking about an incredibly decentralized matrix of information transfer that is phenomenal, especially audience-created content. I mean, you go onto social networking sites in the Arab world, and it's just such a vibrant environment for the transfer of information. And, you know, again, it seems as though these rigid government institutions are eating the dust of these young people who are so, you know, they're so 2011, and these institutions are so 1970s.
Just on a personal note, I gather you spent some of your childhood in Kuwait. Is that right? I mean,
That's correct, yes. You
are of Egyptian ancestry, although you didn't live in Egypt as a child. But you did spend a considerable amount of your time in Kuwait. Is that right?
Absolutely. That's correct, yes.
So does this affect the way you view all this? I mean, I don't know how old you were when you lived there, but do you remember very well a much more controlled information environment than exists in these countries today?
Yeah. It's funny that you say that because the book, the Al Jazeera book that both myself and Dr. Mohammed Nawawi co-authored together starts with a narrative that describes, you know, essentially my experience in Kuwait and my first source of intrigue in how government broadcasting works. I mean, and it was, you know, we were in Kuwait. Iraq had just invaded, Saddam Hussein had just invaded Kuwait. And for a period of a couple of months, there was this sort of very, you know, incredibly unconvincing narrative about how there was a coup d'etat in Kuwait that the Iraqis were supporting, and that eventually the leader of the Kuwaiti military at the time, the leader of the coup, essentially submitted his young nation state, to Iraq, almost as a gift to the motherland. And we watched these absurd ceremonial interactions between this man. His name is Ali Hussein Ali. I don't know what's become of him. I suppose he may have been executed. And Saddam Hussein in these very, very elaborate procedural, passing on of jurisdictional control over Kuwait. And at the same time, we would turn on the radio and there was, you know, we'd listen to Voice of America or BBC or Radio Monte Carlo, and it would describe a completely different story. So we were living in a state of virtual schizophrenia. And at that point, I realized, you know, wow, this is, you know, government broadcasting can be incredibly powerful and incredibly twisted. So that was my early experience with what it means to be a government broadcaster and what the role of subversive media in that environment. Of course, we weren't lucky to have, you know, transnational satellite television in the early 90s, so there was no point of comparison, and it was a very, very ominous situation because we actually didn't know what was going on the ground. Nobody was reporting what was happening in our backyards. But as time went on, I mean, it was only a few years later that Al Jazeera and other satellite stations came into being, and that changed the landscape entirely. So my early experiences very much sort of grounded me in a genuine fear and concern about government broadcasters and how they can be used to abuse power and abuse people's consciousness and what it is that constitutes a reality. So again, one's own experiences are very much related.
So you were probably relatively unusual back then among people in Arab states in having access to alternative media so that you could kind of compare.
Yes, absolutely.
But now everyone just about in the Arab world has access to alternative media in the sense of non-governmental media.
And also participating in the creation of their own media. Yeah. I mean, these revolutions have really showed us that you've got young people across the region who are actively participating in creating new drafts of history, either by photographing or documenting or videotaping events on the ground and then passing them on to satellite TV or distributing them online, but also new creative ways of expression. I mean, they're shooting videos of themselves rapping about demonstrations and revolutions or creating, you know, comic strips and comedy sketches about it. So it's a very, very interesting way to witness the decentralization of information in the region in a manner that we hadn't expected. We always assumed that Arab audiences were passive, that they were apathetic, that the only thing they really cared about was protesting American foreign policy in the region, and that they were incredibly radical. But we've now seen that they're incredibly complex, they're incredibly nuanced, they know how to use technology, and they're very, very imaginative. And these revolutions have been very much a service to reminding us that youth capacities worldwide cannot be hindered when they have the technology on hand and when they have aspirations that they feel can be met.
Okay, final question. Do you think the government in Qatar will eventually become a victim of the forces that it has unleashed?
I think to a large extent it's inevitable that Al Jazeera will have to look in-house. Mm-hmm. And deal with what's going on in Qatar. And I think the Qatari government is probably already contemplating the measures that they will have to take to at least not fall into the trap of hypocrisy. Mm-hmm. They need to open up, and I believe they probably will. There's going to be a lot of scrutiny on Qatar in the next few years as it becomes as the spotlights shine on the country more so, mm-hmm. not just as a result of Al Jazeera, but because of its increasingly momentous role regionally. Eventually, if Al Jazeera were to remain credible and for the Qatari government to continue sponsoring it in the fashion that they have to answer a lot of questions.
Okay.
So I hope that that's what happens. Otherwise, it would hurt both the station and the state to continue overlooking the concerns that both Arab publics and the international community.
But as we speak on February 23rd, there's not mm-hmm. a lot of unrest in Qatar by way of emulating the rest of the Arab world or anything?
Not at all. There are no signs of any protests or but again, you never know. I mean, these things happen.
They can happen fast.
They have a way of just combusting very, very swiftly. So
yeah.
There are a lot of grievances that the Qatari population have,
mm-hmm.
And if they choose to address to make those evident, the Qatari government will have to respond. Otherwise, it will not reflect well
mm-hmm.
On them, and they would fall into the same trap that most of the other governments have.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, the Emir, Sheikh Hamad bin Khalifa Thani, is probably quite mindful of that. And I think measures are being taken. I mean, most governments in the region have already started taking measures. The Saudi government today has increased salaries. The Jordanian government has, shut down or has, forced the parliament into resignation and the cabinet. And so measures are being taken across the board to avert the possibility of this happening.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the Qataris would be well served if they too were to recognize the grievances of at least segments of their population and address them, as well as the concerns of the international community regarding politics and economics and in Qatar and Qatar's relation to various countries in the region. So all of that, I think, is going to open up. I mean, at the end of the day, these revolutions have alerted us to the fact that there's no more Pandora's box in the region or anywhere else. Everything is in the open. Everything, and it's not just Al Jazeera, and it's not just Facebook. It's also WikiLeaks, and there's so many different nodes to this process.
Yeah.
But it's really leveling out the playing field.
It's just
everyone has to answer.
It's just a bad time to be an autocrat,
Absolutely, absolutely.
So I'm going to stay out of the autocracy business myself.
And the bureaucracy and the technocracy, all of those.
Yeah.
It's bad to be all of these.
So thank you so much, Adil. And we will link to your book on the side and encourage people to take a look at it.
Thank you for taking the time and
being with us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Okay. Take care.
You too. Thank you, Bob.
Bye-bye.